It is Saturday, September 20th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, we're covering the geek news in the second half, inviting you to ask us questions about technology.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we have questions and comments about technology. That's right, from you. You can call us up in the second half of the show. Phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, and I'll invite you to do that in about a half an hour, because first, we're going to be doing some geek news. John McCain and Barack Obama face off in foreign policy in Oxford, Mississippi, the first of three presidential debates that may decide the outcome of this close historic race. Join us for an uninterrupted coverage of the debate, followed by in-depth analysis from NPR and foreign policy experts. John McCain and Barack Obama's first debate from KUSP and NPR, Friday evening at 6 p.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP. Oh, that's right. We're going to do something fun today.
KUSP is supported by Briago Solar, offering photovoltaic solutions to enable homes and businesses to be green and resource savvy with sharp solar panels. Briago has 28 years of experience and a local team ready to help. Information at briagosolar.com.
My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks today are Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Sean?
Good morning, Lyle.
I know, it's pretty bad. Last week we had Terry Brooks on, and I just totally messed up that promo for Borrego Solar. I just mutilated it. Anyway, I thought this week I'd type it down and just let my computer do it for me. It was pretty bad, though, wasn't it?
it was kind of cool.
We really should do the whole show like this.
Compared to you, I read it quite well, actually.
I didn't want to say that, but...
Thanks, Miles.
You're welcome, Lyle.
So we've got
who's all here today, Lyle?
All right, let's keep going. That's right. Well, we also have Mr. Miles Elam. He's a slacker, geek, political junkie, programmer, student. Hi.
Hi.
We have Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Morning, Ryder.
Good morning.
It's been a couple weeks. Thanks for coming.
It's been a whole month.
A whole month? Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It's that whole... the whole we're going to have Buzz Aldrin on thing, and we kept on getting John, and anyway, Who knows if that will succeed. Maybe one day we'll get him. Ryder, thank you for being here. I've been missing you, and thanks for showing up. We also have Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben, what the heck are you doing now?
Trying to move
to Berkeley?
You
got an apartment in Berkeley? You want a little cool geek to be there?
Yeah.
Ben Jaffe's your guy. Just send us an email to geekspeak.org. Who is playing with the mic, Sean?
My mic. I didn't move it before the show.
It's all squeak, rumble. All right. Let's do some geek news. Yes.
Don't forget our fifth geek, Alex, the voice from the text-to-speech engine on macOS 10.
I could pipe that through. I guess that would be the thing to do. Huh?
I think you should make commentary on our stories through Alex.
Alex Lias runs our forums, and he also is on chat with us every time we do Geek Speak. And when we sound like we know what we're talking about, it's normally because Alex has chimed in with some feedback.
You know, maybe when Alex... we talk through instant message throughout the show, and when Alex says something that's pertinent to the show, you should just copy it and play it back on the computer.
Yeah, he could be...
He can say, that's very exciting.
Henry Ramirez, DDS.
Oh, no, no,
Geek
no.
Speak is Supper Ted.
Oh, my gosh, I have the wrong thing copied. Anyway, let's move on.
It
could have
been worse.
All right, so let's go ahead and do some geek news today. Mr. Miles Elam, I will start with you, sir.
Do you have a particular story you would like to hear?
I know you have so many.
He's a repository.
You know what? That requires me to be totally right. You know what? Skip Miles. Yeah, Sean, what's going on with Internet DB? The Internet Movie Database.
I want to hear a political story. Miles?
Which one? I've got several.
Give me the most tastiest
rock,
story
paper, scissors,
that you got.
Flip a coin.
Sure. One is talking about the Electronic Freedom Foundation is suing the NSA, President Bush, and Vice President Cheney on behalf of AT&T customers with regard to the illegal warrantless wiretapping.
I heard
or potentially
that.
Illegal, which is why they're suing. They're claiming it. And, of course, the other side is saying we didn't do anything wrong.
What took them so long? Why now?
Well, one of the things that the EFF would need is standing to sue. When you're suing someone, you can't just say, like, hey, this is a wrong thing and I'm going to sue. You actually have to have been the one who has been wronged. So what they have done is actually filed on behalf of five individual plaintiffs who are AT&T customers. And apparently they're finding some evidence that they specifically have been wronged. So that may have been the issue, is trying to find people that to be willing to be named plaintiffs in the suit.
So they know they were listened in on?
Technically, we all were, if you have an AT&T connection.
Yeah.
But not listened in on, but the logs were looked
right.
at.
Right. Yeah.
This is the famous closet in San Francisco?
Yes. San Francisco, Seattle,
what do you mean
Albuquerque.
What do you mean
famous closet?
Famous closet. What are you talking about?
There was a closet set up in, it was first found in the San Francisco office, where basically a network engineer was trying to figure out what a problem was and had another employee saying, hey, I have this key to this really cool room, you know, someone with loose lips. And what it was, and there was some network outage going on. The guy was like, what's going on here? If I send the routing just straight out, everything works fine. But if I route through this room where the route is, where somebody else had put it through, things start happening. And he started looking a little bit more and trying to get more information out of some people who weren't quite up to speed with, you know, the so-called secrets, and found that basically what AT&T was doing was colluding with the government to have all information that's traveling through their networks routed to another area, basically for the NSA to be able to do data mining on.
Yep.
Presumably for data mining for any type of illicit communications by terrorists, a very vague term, but it was happening on U.S. soil, and they were also monitoring domestic calls from domestic to domestic as opposed to domestic to international.
So this is now being a lawsuit from the Electronic Freedom Foundation against Bush, Cheney, and what, the
NSA?
The NSA?
Right.
That actually
and the
executed
NSA.
It? All right, interesting. Thank you.
So do they have any
possibility of winning? I mean, I don't know if you can actually sue government
well,
officials.
Well, that's... I mean, does the ACLU have any possibility of winning some case? Yes, they do. Some cases, other ones they don't. It all depends upon the judge, depends upon
right.
how evidence is gathered.
And I'm assuming that they're attacking governmental... They're suing governmental because the Congress went ahead and made the phone companies immune from any prosecution.
Right.
So that's the idea to go on to the next step. All right, well, thank you, Miles, for that. I really
and
appreciate
just
it.
If people don't know what the Electronic Frontier Foundation is, they're very much like the ACLU, only for the online world.
And
just to give
influence.
A point of context.
Yeah, they've
thank
helped
you.
A lot of people.
Thank you. Sean, what's going on with the Internet Movie Database? What's new?
They're playing full movies and TV shows now.
So you can go up to this website and actually watch movies.
Yeah. What's incredible is that the IMDb.com Internet Movie Database has been kind of the same for the last 15 years. I mean, really, they've not embraced anything new.
What, less than 15?
Maybe, yeah.
The Internet
early 90s, right? They've been around
the
forever.
The Internet only really went public, what, 95?
Yeah, I guess that's probably right, mid-90s. Well, anyway, they haven't changed. I think we can all agree on that. And they are now using Hulu and also a smaller portion from CBS and Sony and independent movie makers to host full movies and TV shows. And, you know, I went up there and checked it out, and it's commercial driven. So
it's
just where there would be a commercial break in a TV show, they do, you know, a commercial, and then it comes back right where it left off.
You are absolutely right, though. It does look like a site made for Netscape 2.0.
Yeah.
Or maybe 3.0. It has tables, but it has background colors on those tables.
And, you know, the classic TV, they got Charlie's Angels, the A-Team, Star Trek, Beauty and the Beast. I guess there's a season of Beauty and the Beast. I didn't even know that. And then a whole bunch of independent shorts and new movies and older movies. Weird Science is up there. Madness of King George, Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I watched Firefly. And it was actually, it sounded great. It looked great. I mean, it's a small window, but you
You can't expand the window out?
I didn't try. We should.
And of course, they've been doing trailers for a while. Yeah, pretty impressive.
Well, you know who wrote Beauty and the Beast?
Who?
George R. R. Martin.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
He's one of our favorite authors.
Yeah, he's a great fantasy author. Next news story. Ryder, hi.
Hi. Okay. So I stumbled across this little article I thought was pretty geeky. There is a professor, informatics professor at UC Irvine, who received a $100,000 grant to study why Americans like to create mods to World of Warcraft more frequently than the Chinese do.
What are mods?
Mods in World of Warcraft, I believe, are basically software modifications to customize your character and
the
behaviors
world,
in the world. Yeah. So it's I think it's actually something that World of Warcraft in some cases condemns. They've been actually depending on the type of modification, because some people will actually cheat, create gold, create equipment that wouldn't normally be spawned in the world, things like that.
I didn't know you could hack the world like that. I didn't know there was that level.
I believe, there
you can hack your character, like how it interacts with the world, so that it fights more efficiently.
Yeah, no, I've heard that there's actually hacks, and they get slammed down because they basically destroy the economy, virtual economy.
So more of these are happening in the U.S. players?
But, yeah, and what... First of all, it just strikes me funny that... I mean, this was the National Science Foundation that actually, granted $100,000. I mean, does it take $100,000 to study that? I mean, a World of Warcraft game, costs, maybe a couple $100 in registration fees, and... I guess you're paying for a salary for a professor to study this.
Well, you're actually paying for grad students. You're not paying
grad
for
students. Yeah. Well, she has one assistant helping her. Her name is blah, 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 Bonnie Nardi. So, interesting though. Apparently, stats that came up when I was reading this article is that there's 5 million Chinese people playing World of Warcraft out of a total of 10 million global users.
Wait, say that again. How many?
5 million.
5 million World of Warcraft from
versus
China.
About 2.5 million U.S. players.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, that is some revenue stream they've got going.
Serious. Are there two different universes for language differences? Because people actually type stuff in World of Warcraft, right?
They have different domains that you can join, so they're probably...
So these people are not playing together necessarily.
Yeah, there are multiple... I mean, it's all the same world, but different groups of people. So you may not see... If you only go into one... I forget the name of what they call it. It's considered a domain, though, or a particular...
Yeah, the first game to do really good translation services... Mm-hmm. It's just going to rule.
Here's a question for it. Translation is
very difficult to translate those languages on the fly.
It's difficult to translate any language that has real meaning. But, World of Warcraft, interesting to me, that a whole 5 million Chinese are playing it. I wonder what would happen to Blizzard's financial situation if China closed it off with the Great Wall of China. And all that would have to happen is a few people to go up there and have an effective way of communicating free speech in that environment, and the Chinese government might turn it off. I wonder if that will happen. I guess that's a little bit of a prediction I could see.
Yeah. If there's 5 million people in one space. It's a very social game, there is potential in that.
If it affects the their ability to produce Diablo 3, then I'll be very upset. Because that's the only game I care about from Blizzard.
You're not into the new StarCraft.
Lyle is a StarCraft player of old.
Yes, I used to.
Well, we used to. Yeah.
Miles used to play StarCraft.
We should have been working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was fun. Anyway, I don't have time to game anymore. So let's go to the last geek that hasn't spoken yet, and he's been around for a while. And I guess through the chat, you're asking me, Ben, if you can say poop on air. Yeah, I think you can, if it's appropriate and important to the story.
All right, it is, because I want to talk about dog droppings and a particularly geeky way people are dealing with it. So the city of going to butcher this, but a city in Israel, Petach Tikva, anyway, started a pilot program.
Do you want the computer to say it? We could put it in the computer and say it that way.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll work on that.
All right, we'll work on it. PTAH.
Anyway, go on. Go on.
Got the headline.
They started a pilot program to punish people who don't pick up their dog's droppings and to reward those who do pick them up. And of course, with fines like these kinds of fines, enforcement is a huge problem, because people can deny it or, you just happen to be at the right place and right time to catch this. But this city is actually using a DNA database of the dogs in the city to match the feces to the registered dog and to identify the owner.
Wait. So people that let their dog, they don't pick up after their dog. Mm-hmm. Somebody goes around and gets samples of it when they clean it up.
Apparently.
And then they put that in the, they do a DNA test against this sample of this feces. Mm-hmm. And
match it up with the
match
dog.
It up with dogs on file. I guess you have to get, when you get a permit, you have to get your dog's
DNA. Yeah, it's just a pilot program, but they're actually thinking about making it a law that you have to register your dog or, you know, give DNA sample.
Why don't they just take the expenses for this program and hire a guy to go around and pick up the feces?
Well, I guess ideally.
Yeah, who has that job?
Well, you know, it's the same.
Are they picking it up when they take the sample? Or are they just taking a sample and leaving it? That's what I want to know.
Well, the thing is that that's the great thing is it's because, I mean, the fine would be very high, right? Mm-hmm. So the fines theoretically could pay for somebody to move, to go around and clean up. Now, I didn't know that you could get enough DNA to do a match like that. But the other thing that's amazing to me is that makes any financial sense at all. I guess DNA testing is a lot easier than we thought.
I guess cheaper and easier than before.
Well, it depends on how much the fine is, too.
That's true. Maybe they have to cover the cost of the DNA.
If the fine is $300, then you might be able to do it.
Yeah, and you're picking that up.
Yeah, and also, you know, once your neighbor gets fined, you're not going to leave dog droppings on the sidewalk. True. So they're really not going to have to do this
now,
very much.
Now, if it's a pilot program, they're going to have some benefit to people that do pick it up. And
yes, in fact. They have coupons that they give to people who consistently pick up their dog poop for dog food and dog treats. I feel like it should be human food and human treats or you know, something. Yeah, I mean, you know, okay, reward
now,
your dog
stuff,
yeah, that's true. That is true. That's definitely true. Definitely a financial incentive to on both ends to pick up.
Yeah, one bad side to this, though, is for those of us who have dogs, we're walking along and we'll see some dog feces that doesn't belong to any of our dogs.
We'll pick
it up because it makes us look bad as dog owners when there is dog poop sitting around. Mm. So.
Okay, here's the city.
Petotikva.
Does it sound?
Petotikva.
We'll go with that.
All right.
There you go. You're saved. All right. Thank you for that story about dog feces. I really appreciate that, Ben. Mm-hmm. And DNA testing.
See, I said feces.
What a
droppings.
Way to... I know. I was the only one that said the other word. What a way to wake up in the morning, huh? Let's go
to Sean. I woke up to that story. That was the first one I opened. Ooh.
Sean, hi.
Hi. Thanks. Hey, this is a really interesting story. This former NASA scientist, John Mankins, has demonstrated solar power transmission from satellite to Earth.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
So he
very nice.
He used radio waves to transmit solar power a distance of 92 miles between two Hawaiian islands.
Wow. Okay, so one of the biggest problems about using solar panels in the outside the atmosphere, where the sun always shines, you know, orbiting Earth, or trailing Earth is actually the sweet spot because you don't have to orbit Earth. You can kind of orbit the sun with a drag from Earth. In any case, the biggest problem is how do you get the power from those solar panels down to Earth? And the idea of beaming power has always been this desirable thing, and this guy's done some beaming of power. That's really cool. And how far?
92 miles.
In atmosphere.
He transmitted 20 watts of power between two islands in May.
Did it take him 5 days?
Well, he said the receivers were so small that less than 1/1000th of a percent of the power was received. Uh-huh. So, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done, but he proved it could be done.
Well, even with a lot of loss, if you built a big enough system, it could be potentially a boon.
It was funded by the Discovery Channel, and it looks like they did a story on it last night, Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Discovery Channel has been doing a lot of stories about environmentally friendly or, you know, sustainable power, mm-hmm. this, that. They've been airing them. They're actually really, really neat. I'd recommend checking out
the show is Discovery Project Earth.
Yeah, yeah. A friend
Orbital
of mine
Power
did one
Plan.
Of them.
So, really
Lyle,
interesting, really.
Yeah.
Lyle, as our resident electronics geek, how would that...
Is that all I am to you, Miles?
Yes, that is. This was terrestrial. This is within, you know, just close to sea level.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the effect of trying to transmit this through the ionosphere?
That's a good question. If you're going... Well, if you're inside the magnetic sphere to some degree, you're going to have less of a problem. The big reason why we don't get as much radiation from the sun has to do with the giant magnetic sphere of the mm-hmm. planet. But as you get into low orbit, you have less of that to contend to. But also, if you go straight in from the poles, you should be able to get through it. You might bend it. It might affect the beam. But it shouldn't be that big of a deal. And the biggest thing that I would see would be the problem is that you're going to want to beam to one location on Earth or maybe a few locations.
So geosynchronous?
Targeting that's going to be hard unless you're geosynchronous. Of course, you're geosynchronous, then you're going to be going through shadow. You'll have night and day. So you're kind of defeating half the purpose of this. So I guess it's possible you'd have some kind of network or retargeting. It's probably a long ways off, I would say. The next thing is we could just get off planet, you know, go up to the moon and enjoy it there or something. All right. Well, thank you very much for this experiment about space solar power. Very cool stuff. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah.
I've lost track of who's next, but let's go ahead and go to Ryder Brooks.
Okay. I found an interesting little hack that we all know about the SciStar cloning computer system game. SciStar, that's the name of it, isn't it?
SciStar. I haven't heard about it.
It's the company that built the Mac clone that got sued by Apple.
Oh, yes. Okay, so a company came out, tried to make a Macintosh clone, and then got shut down quick.
So another company has come up with an alternative to building a whole clone computer that causes the legal conflict with Apple. What they've created is a bootable flash drive that's basically plugs into a 10-pin internal USB inside your computer and boots to its own firmware that basically allows you, without modifying your Apple Leopard Apple CD, you can just boot straight to it. All your hardware works. It's expensive. It's basically geared toward enthusiasts. There's a limited hardware list
as
well.
So the idea being that you get some hardware that would be compatible with OS X's operating system. Yeah. And then the issue is that the software license of Leopard, which you have to sign to use as if all software kind of infers a signature of that, that it says you cannot do certain things like modify the OS. And then, therefore, if they just modify the hardware, which is something that they owned, and pretend that they are Macintosh hardware, then the operating system doesn't have to be modified and it will still run. Mm-hmm. That's the basic idea?
Which is basically what the SciStar company had done.
That's pretty cool.
Which is technically a violation of the licensing because Apple states that it has to be run on Apple hardware.
So what does this USB thing do that's different?
It doesn't modify the hardware. It's basically a plug-in component that you need to boot from it. And basically what they called a bootable firmware. But basically what it does is it recreates the EFI open firmware that Apple uses to verify that it's a genuine Apple product.
Do you think this is going to win? Do you think Apple's just going to slam
this? I think it'll probably get slammed down the road, but it's pretty obscure. I mean, the biggest limitation here is that it only runs on Gigabyte motherboards.
Mm.
There's a short list of...
Isn't it Gigabit?
The brand name, Gigabyte.
Gigabyte? I thought it was Gigabyte. All right, well, thank you, Ryder, for that. Yeah. Miles, I think I kind of skipped you. Go ahead, we'll take the next last news story before we take the break. Go ahead.
Sure. Once again, some political news. This refers to voting machines, a common theme for our show in terms of criticisms. This time, a new study by Common Cause and the Century Foundation has found that 10 states have significant voting problems that haven't been addressed since they last had the voting problems in 2006.
You mean they haven't even been touched? Nothing's been done?
Right. So, if someone has done something, it was completely ineffectual. So they had these problems back in 2006, reported problems like 20,000 people leaving polling places because of a crashed computer registration and long lines or things like that.
So these 10, are these certain districts or certain states?
No, these are states. And these are states that are commonly swing states. So these are places like Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Michigan, Ohio.
Are these just New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Wisconsin? Are these just electronic voting or any kind of voting?
This is electronic voting, specifically.
Why aren't these states handling this?
There's a fine question. One, there's a fair amount of money involved. Like, for example, the Secretary of State in California, who said all of these voting machines, electronic voting machines for a particular county were invalid, could not be used. It left that county alert because they had spent all that money for the voting machines, and now all that money was just gone.
And the state didn't come up and try to provide more money to those districts?
I don't have any up-to-date information. At the time, it hadn't.
You know, I got to say, the more I learn about electronic voting and all the problems that we're having, the more I support John Tracy's suggestion, which is one of the other geeks. Paper, pencil, scan them, keep them. It's like,
there's another question, though, is that in Florida in the 2000 election, you had punch cards
right,
that were put through a machine and read, because everything is read by a machine of some sort, even if it isn't a computer. And one of the issues was that people were just having the computer retabulate results and not actually counting the original cards. So you do have that paper trail, but it still requires that people step up and check the original paper trail.
That's fine, I suppose.
Assuming that an electronic voting
machine... Assuming there is some kind of paper trail, and electronic voting machines don't even have that. So.
Some electronic voting machines don't. There are other ones that do give a paper receipt. So it comes a question of, one, people need to go and make sure that it does have that receipt. But also, I think this puts it out there for people to keep an eye on this, that this is something to watch out for.
Thank you, Miles. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. You can also find him at RamirezDDS.com, I believe. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks today are Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, Ryder Brooks, and Sean Cleveland. We're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. Please give us a ring now if you'd like to ask us anything. Join us for KOSP's 28th year of live broadcast from the Monterey Jazz Festival. Your favorite jazz and blues hosts will bring this world-class event to the best seat in your house with exclusive artist interviews and performances. This afternoon's lineup takes the stage at 1 p.m. and features Let Us See, the Miles, second paragraph, go.
This afternoon's lineup takes the stage at 1 p.m. and features Let Us See, the Maceo Parker Band, with their special guests, the MJF Next Generation Jazz Orchestra and the Derek Trucks Band. The Monterey Jazz Festival live broadcast exclusively on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Thank you, Miles, for that. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. That was Miles Elam. We also have in the house with us Ryder Brooks. He happens to be a bit of a Linux expert. We have Ben.
A bit of a Linux expert?
Yeah. Yeah, he worked for that company, Sco.
And now he works at Sun.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing.
He's a little more than a bit of a Linux expert.
And not just Linux, I do Unix.
You do everything.
Yes.
I can't list everybody's like abilities because it would take too long.
Ben Jaffe, like who's been teaching at Stanford.
That's right.
And how old are you?
14, I think, 14.
Mm-hmm. No, really, it's pretty amazing, the summer program you did.
Yeah, that's definitely fun. All about computer making games using Windows.
Video software. Game design and web design, yeah.
Multimedia, I guess we'll have to have a show about that.
It was pretty cool. He did a demo recently for me, and it's neat stuff. He's teaching my kid, too. Thanks, Ben, for being here. And we also have Sean Cleveland, expert in hardware, all things, and science fiction and fantasy books. And, in any case, let's go on.
It's my fault that you guys have had to listen to the author shows.
That's right.
You can blame Rick and I. Rick Kleffel.
Go ahead and join our conversation right now. Pick up your phone, 476-2800. Again, 476-2800, and that's in the 831 area code. If you're outside the 831 area code, don't call us long distance. We'll pay the bill. 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-KUSP. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. All right, I think that's right. I want to let you know that Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Dr. Don Motika and OptimageHealth.com in Santa Cruz, offering specialized testing, nutritional therapy, and medical management to prevent serious health effects following weight loss surgery. Appointments at OptimageHealth.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Arto. This is Geek Speak. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. I think it is Ben's turn for news. Maybe it's Sean's, but Ben, go for it.
Sure. So the loudness war is a phrase that's been used to refer to how compression and limiting has been used in songs on CDs more and more, approaching the time we are at now, the last 10 or 15 years. And basically what that does is compressors take your dynamic range of the audio, in other words, the quietest quiets and the loudest louds, and it smooshes them all up together to make the whole sound louder, so it's not as dynamic. And limiters do a similar thing. They just crunch out the peaks, which are the loudest portions. So Guitar Hero has this nice mix of this particular song, Metallica's Death Magnetic. And the CD that they recently released, that Metallica released, is way more compressed and limited than the Guitar Hero version, and all of the fans who bought the CD are very angry because it doesn't sound very good. And actually, after
Which version doesn't sound
the,
good?
The CD version doesn't sound good.
Sean, yeah. I was listening all the way here. It sounded great.
Yeah?
Yeah, I guess we like I guess we
well,
like
if, if you compare it to if you compare it to the other one, and there's actually a YouTube, of course YouTube doesn't give great sound quality, but you know, they lowered the volumes enough so you can tell the difference, the dynamic range difference.
I'd love to hear bass for once on a Metallica album.
Yeah.
It's like they always hide the bass. Well, since
you turn up the bass in your car stereo to 5.
You know, it's very common for radio stations to do compression. In fact, there's an Optimage compressor behind me. You see all those dials things flying down? That's a digital compressor. One of the things about KOSP that I've liked for a long time, because we're playing jazz and classical in the evenings, and we've done that for a long time, is that our air quality is very important to us. So the engineer Brandt and the station manager Terry are light on compression. That doesn't make us have that commercial sound, but it's actually one of the reasons why you can flip through your dial and kind of know when you're listening to a public radio, because a lot of public radio don't do compression a lot.
Mm-hmm.
When
so you're it's commercial, quieter.
Yeah, and when you're a commercial radio, you try to bump that volume up all the time, and it theoretically makes the station sound louder. Which is great, I guess, for pop music, but not so great when you're listening to classical.
It's also especially great because if you're the only station in town who isn't doing that, then all the other stations are going to sound louder, more powerful, better signal, whatever.
I used to, when I got out of college, I went right to a company that made compressors, and one of the things that frustrated me so much is, why isn't this compressor stuff on the radios and not the transmitters? You know, we should transmit non-audio compression and just let people change the settings the way they want them.
Well, because if you do that, then one radio station, maybe owned by Clear Channel or something, might say, oh, well, let's compressor is a little bit more than the rest of them, and then sound lighter when you're flipping between
dials. That's the reason why the quality sounds so bad when you're listening to music on a lot of radio stations, and why whenever I can, I listen to KOSPs. But that sounds like a lot of advertisement for KOSP, and I'm so sorry I just did that.
Well,
just personal taste.
anyway. But anyway, the CD version has been way more heavily compressed and limited and clipped, and they analyzed it and saw that the CD version is actually 10 decibels louder, effectively, minus the peaks, is 10 decibels louder than the Guitar Hero version, which to our ear sounds about twice as loud, which is huge, you know? And actually, almost 3,000 fans at the writing of the article I'm reading had signed a petition asking that they remix the album with less or no compression. And then also the article comments that says, failing that, someone will eventually record themselves playing the song perfectly within the game and then distribute it via BitTorrent. You know, so
is this GarageBand that's happening? Or Guitar Hero?
Guitar Hero.
Okay, so when you're playing Guitar Hero, if you don't play at all, does the music get damaged? I mean, is the music in the system where you can just listen to it as well?
No, if you're I don't believe so. But I know that if you're actually playing the game and you're playing on the guitar, if you miss a note, the guitar track will actually cut out. Uh-huh. So inside the game, the tracks are actually separated.
Right.
So if you were to somehow get that audio, that data out of the game, I'm not sure how they store it, but you could actually conceivably remix the entire song or just, you know, re-record yourself playing guitar or something. I don't know.
The entire song as it was meant, you've got to play it perfectly.
Yeah, and you know, eventually someone,
those guitars are crazy on that album.
Yeah.
They're fast.
Well, the thing is, when you're playing Garage Hero, you're not really playing the music.
You're still tapping really fast.
Yeah, it's true.
Wow.
Yeah, the blast beat that's going on too. I mean, how would you do that on the drum kit? Anyway, let's go on. Let's go and take some calls. Thanks, Ben, for that.
Yeah.
From San Martin, Jackie, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm sitting here at the kitchen table with me on my Windows ThinkPad and my daughter on her new Mac Pro laptop.
Okay.
But she needs to still use some Windows applications in her last year of high school before she converts entirely to just a Macintosh person.
Okay, what applications?
We're trying to figure out how to get all these different Windows programs on there, and I guess we need to load a Windows operating system onto her Mac.
Well, first off, what applications does she need?
Word, the basics.
Okay,
mostly
so
Word,
so cool there's
stuff because right now
there's a Macintosh version of Word. There's a Macintosh
PowerPoint.
Version. Can you hear me okay? Are you on a speakerphone or something? You might want to pick up.
Yeah, I am. Should I turn it off?
Go ahead and pick up. Yeah. Microsoft offers a Macintosh version of Word, Excel, the whole Office suite. Doesn't have PowerPoint, but other than that, it's the full suite. So why not just get that? That might be easier. From a financial situation, if you want to do this legally, there's a few applications, a few things that allow you to install on a Mac, and you can do that. But you've got to pay for the operating system itself, which costs, I don't know how much does Windows cost.
Sure, and then we were trying not to get the Vista, and it was like,
I don't know if you can, yeah.
Is it
XP, Windows XP. Is there
XP,
anything else besides Word and Excel that you need to use on that machine?
She was talking about PowerPoint.
PowerPoint's a bit of a problem. There's actually a Macintosh version of a presentation software that's like PowerPoint, and it can read and save PowerPoint files, and that's called Keynote. Ben, you were going to say this, weren't you? You raised your hand.
No. Okay. I was going to say
Keynote,
something else.
So if you went ahead and bought a Macintosh version of Office and then also got Apple's Keynote software, you would have that full set. And I think it's going to be easier than doing Windows. But let's say you want to go to Windows. And let's say you get an XP CD. There's an app that you can first...
Yeah, we can't find an XP CD.
Yeah, that's a little...
And we even have a relative at Microsoft.
Yeah, it's hard to do. I don't even know if you can. But one of the things you could technically do is take an old Windows computer and use that software license and stop using it on Windows. The other thing is Microsoft doesn't stop you from installing on two different machines. So if you've got it installed on your laptop, you could technically install it on her laptop and you'd be set. But
That's the thing is, how do you get it off the laptop?
You can't take it off of a computer. You have to get the install CD that came with the computer.
Yeah,
the install CDs also, when they do come, or if they don't come, you can actually ask them for it. It's going to be set up only for that hardware. So it's a bit of an issue. Now, you can go to a company called Parallels?
There's Parallels, and then there's VMware Fusion is another one of the products.
A free one that you can actually get from Sun, a plug, is VirtualBox.
VirtualBox.
Yeah, it's an open source application. It runs free. It actually runs on Windows, Mac, Linux, Solaris. So that's your free option.
Ryder, will you put that
17-year-old way? I already have VirtualBox.
You do? Great.
Ryder, will you go ahead and put... So you already have VirtualBox. That's great. So you install it. The next thing is you're going to have to get a Windows CD. And then during the process of getting VirtualBox running, you have to then install the software inside the machine. And then once you do that,
so
it's going to start. And once you do that, it's going to start up no problem. It's just that it's going to be a little slower on the machine. And running Office Suite and stuff like that is going to be less enjoyable than going ahead and having those software installed directly on Macintosh. So I would recommend getting the software and installing it on her OS. Also, because after high school, she's going to keep wanting to use Word and Excel, and I think pretty much all the Mac users I know still have Word and Excel on their machines. So thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Jackie. Bye-bye.
One more option for OS X, there's I'm not sure if it's open source, but anyway, it's free to download called NeoOffice, and that's basically a Microsoft Word clone. They also have an Excel product within NeoOffice, which does Excel and Excel files, also does PowerPoint. And it'll read and write Microsoft Word files and PowerPoint files. If you end up going that route at NeoOffice and you would want to go into the preferences and make sure that when it saves files, it defaults to saving in Microsoft Word format,
right,
and not in OpenOffice format.
Yeah, NeoOffice is actually a Macintosh wrapping of OpenOffice, which is a free Office suite, which means it's got Word and Excel and something, a couple other things. And it's a great application. I know a lot of people that actually use it as their primary. The thing is, you have to take some time. You have to invest a couple hours in getting used to using this other application and getting installed correctly and making it work. But I hear NeoOffice makes that a lot easier. So if you're on a Macintosh and you don't want to spend money on Office Suite, try NeoOffice.
Yeah, it's money versus time, really.
What is it, NeoOffice.org?
Yeah, NeoOffice.org. And the other thing is PowerPoint for Mac. Microsoft does have PowerPoint for Mac. And I believe...
Oh, it does.
And
right.
I believe it's... yeah.
Good. Let's go ahead and go to Royal Oaks. Ken, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, guys. I was going out of Costco and checking out getting a Q6600 processor in a system, a PC system. And there's, strangely enough, you can still get XP, which I thought they had, I know they don't support it, but you can still get it in one of their systems. At least this is their online Costco thing. So I was looking at, I'm really looking at four different operating systems, which is kind of confusing. So I could get a Intel quad system with XP. I could get it with Vista Home. I could get it with Vista, what is it called, Premium or some professional or something, 32-bit or 64-bit. So I do a lot of music and AV applications.
Ooh, what?
So I really want the four cores supported as much as possible. And I had read something that said XP maybe doesn't support, you know, spreading out your data or your processing across the four cores as much as maybe XP Pro. And then the other question is, you know, 32 or 64, you know, bit.
Okay, so what Sean and I are doing is running Vista 64. Sean, yeah. You have more input on that?
Well, yeah, XP is not supported anymore. So yeah, you won't see any more updates
for that.
They
still sell it, oddly enough.
Well, they sell it, but you won't be seeing any more updates.
Yeah.
So I just would not recommend buying XP.
Okay,
if you're using it and it's working fine for you, then certainly don't move away. But at some point, something's going to happen, and it's going to need an update. Microsoft's not going to have it, and then you're going to be forced to move.
And the only real question has to do with the software you're using and whether it's up to date and how important that software is to you. So if you're a sound engineer and you've got certain products, what are you using right now for your software?
Let's see. I'm using Traction 3, which is pretty advanced, I'm sure.
Yeah, Traction has Vista support.
Yeah, so Vista 32 and 64-bit versions come with Vista. If you buy a retail version, except for the lowest end version. But I would not go, and if you're going to buy a new computer, memory is so inexpensive right now that you want at least 4 gigs.
And the systems come, a Q6600 generally comes with 4 as a base.
But the problem is if you're on Vista 32-bit, you will not see all 4 gigs of memory. You'll be lucky if you see 2.75 gig.
Oh, my God. You're kidding me.
No, I'm serious.
I didn't know that.
Audio engineers, RAM is so important.
So if you want to take advantage of the entire 4 gigs of memory in the system, you've got to have a 64-bit OS.
Wow. That's great. You told me that.
Thanks, Ken, for the call.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Sean, you got a wow. He liked your response.
Yeah, 64 doesn't really give you much else. But that memory support, that's a big deal.
And you need a lot of memory when you're running Vista, too.
And 4 gigs of RAM is not, it's a lot of RAM, but it's not beyond the pale like it used to be.
Yeah. Right.
It's now.
You will see a performance increase by going to 4 gigs. But going to 8 gig, not so much. So don't waste your money.
It depends on what you're running, right?
Yeah.
If you're running on something that would have to swap to hard drive, that's always going to be the case.
And a lot of software stuff, when you're doing like conversion from MIDI to audio samples, you've got these giant library of audio samples.
I guess, yeah.
That's when it actually could come in handy.
You know, the data that I have is for gaming.
Right.
8 gigs won't get you anything for gaming.
I could also see video editing and video rendering.
Any of that. Anything you could like take stuff off the drive and put it in RAM and use it there is going to be really sweet.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go ahead and go to Watsonville. Judith, welcome to Geek Speak. I don't even have you turned up, Judith. Hi, Judith. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. I was just calling about a news story about Larry Cafiero, I think his name is, and
in
his
Felton.
Project about Lindependence in 2008 in Felton, trying to get Felton converted to a all Linux town.
Yeah,
Are you familiar with that project going on?
Well, I know of the Linux group in Felton. In fact, I mention it when they do have events. I mention that they're doing that. The general idea is that the operating systems that we use, Macintosh and Windows operating systems, are created by companies, and to use them, you have to agree to their legal.
End user license agreements.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And the general idea is that those actually restrict your freedom. So if you move away from those operating systems and go to systems like Linux, you're going to be technically more free in your home. And so the movement, which is kind of all over the nation in small sets, is to get people to understand that they actually have an ability to run Linux and to move them on to Linux. And it's a Herculean task, and I support it. And I also regularly recommend that people stay on the operating system they're comfortable with because it would cause them less pain. But if you feel very strongly about your personal rights and you feel that you want to help participate in making people more free in the what they use and how they manage their knowledge, because, of course, our computers are kind of tied to our knowledge, then you probably want to be moving to a free operating system, Linux-based.
Is Linux generally to be a pretty stable operating system?
Yes, I would say.
And do they? Is there a lot of software to do, like, a lot of different things, like music or art?
I would say no to that, okay.
Really want to do stuff like that, probably sticking with Mac?
Well, let me put it this way. I'm a digital photographer. I do a lot of poster design kind of stuff and a lot of layout things. And I'm a geek that can run Linux no problem. It would be easy for me to run Linux as my primary. And I don't. I run Macintosh OS and Windows.
Yeah, the art, I would say you'd have a problem. The music actually has gotten a lot better. There are some good apps, and the Ubuntu Studio
for audio editing.
Yeah, has done a good job with that.
Yeah, and for playback and stuff, you know, that's no problem. For web browsers, no problem. You can do a lot of the things you can do. In fact, OpenOffice, which is the full Office suite, Windows, you know, Word and Excel and so on, that's available. OpenOffice is available on Linux, and it runs really well. So you can do your word processing and your browsing and your music listening and a little bit of music editing, no problem on a Linux machine.
On a Linux machine, but the art work is kind of things is not...
Well, there's an application. What do you use for art? Do you use Photoshop?
Well, I don't. I've used more. I mean, I'm talking about like the drawing kinds of things that you would have in like the Apple Works. I mean, just real basic stuff.
No, yeah, you're going to find that stuff. No problem. That stuff exists. There's what is Inkscape on a Macintosh, which is also a Linux version.
And I do. I also use like iWeb, you know, and putting things with, you know, having been able to put things with different
you can do that. You could move to Linux and you're going to have a learning curve though.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's going to kind of not be so much fun.
But fairly simple type artistic kinds of your things like with
gradient things
and shapes and
I mean the GIMP, which is a graphics program, is very good. It's just not the level of cleanness that like something as Photoshop is. But if you're not using Photoshop, using something else, moving to something like this would probably be okay.
The GIMP is kind of like Photoshop from 7 years ago.
Yeah, Photoshop 4.0.
Yeah, so if you'd ever used that and you were okay with that back then, that's where it's at.
So,
but if you need something more cutting edge, then you need something different.
So Judith, what I would recommend is go ahead and go to Ubuntu and Ubuntu.org, I think, and go ahead and get one of their live CDs. And this is basically an operating system. You've got to burn a copy. You can actually ask them to send you a CD, and they will. And you can just donate $1 or something if you'd like to cover the postage. But what this will do is you'll stick this in your machine. Make sure to get the Macintosh version if you're on a Mac. And reboot your machine, and you'll be running Linux on your machine. You can try it out. And if you don't like it, you don't have to move forward. But if you like it, you can have it installed.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Just one rather brief comment. You were talking about Keynote.
Yeah.
And that's a part of iWork would be actually what they would buy because it's bundled
with
Pages.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. iWork is Apple's software version for Keynote. Yeah, it's a great app. I think it sells separately.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I think it sells separately. But
yeah, I think so too.
But you're right. The deal is probably best to buy both Numbers as well. And Numbers is Apple's Excel version. Thank you very much, Judith, for the call. Mm-hmm. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's go ahead and go to Felton. Morris, welcome to Geek Speak. What's your question about graphic cards?
Hi, I want basic education, please. Is graphics card a video card?
Yes.
And how important is it to get a video so I can watch a movie on my screen, on my computer? Is it like I saw graphics cards with fans on them?
Yeah. So the higher end enthusiast cards certainly have fans because they run faster and they're more meant for gaming. You don't really need a high end graphics. They call them GPUs, graphics processing unit, as opposed to the CPU, which is the computer processing or the central processing unit. But it is a video card. You don't need a high end gaming card to watch movies, though. Most modern cards offload all of the HD codecs. So there's H.264, VC1, and MPEG-2 are the three most popular codecs that are used for Blu-ray movies. And most, I would say, mainstream mid-range graphics cards will do that for you. And you can buy those without fans. They have larger heat sinks, but you'll still need good cooling inside your case.
And kind of the simpler answer to your question, Morris, is that the term graphics card is taken over from video cards, partially because of this confusion. So a graphics card runs your monitor, whether it be an LCD, a projector, a normal television-type monitor, right, CRT. And that's what it does is it runs that. And so it handles graphics for you. It gives you the visualization and handles all that processing. When we talk about video on a computer, we're really talking about streaming images, right? And that's what we conceptually talk about video, like television and movies. So, yes, it handles that as well. And what Sean is saying is that the higher-end quality video content, the HD content, which comes on Blu-ray and other forms, you kind of have to have a high-end... I mean, having a high-end graphics card means that your machine works less to do the rendering of the video. And if your system's slow enough without one of those cards, you will get a very choppy, bad experience, and you won't even be able to deal with Blu-ray. And so you need a graphics card that you need a high-end computer and or a graphics card in a computer to really get a full experience.
Yeah, but to play Blu-ray quality video, it requires a monitor that has what's called HDCP, HD copy protection support, and a Blu-ray player, really expensive. But if you just want to watch movies on the internet or DVDs, then a $60 video card should do you just fine.
Thank you very much for the call, Morris.
Hey, thank you so much.
I think that's the last question for the call for today, but we could probably cover one more news story. Who's the best one? Miles, you had a long list. I'll just go with you for de facto.
Sure. As I go back through my list to try to find it again, hold on just
You're not moment. Prepared all the time? I'm sitting here on the other side of the board. I'm prepared. I'll cover one. You want to talk about... Well, go ahead. What?
Online gamers tend to have this... there's a stereotype about them. They're pasty white, kind of overweight, a little chunky. Turns out...
Why are you describing me right now? I don't play online games.
Turns out that when researchers have taken a look at people who played, for example, EverQuest 2, one of the massively multiplayer online games that are out there, turns out that gamers are actually more fit than the average American. They actually have a body mass index of about 25.2 as opposed to the overall American average of 28.
Why is this?
They're not quite sure. One of the reasons they thought might be because the gamers will tend to be more educated and wealthier, and that segment will be more attracted to computer games. And that segment also tends to take better care of their health.
Interesting.
This does not include console games. They were saying that that was a very different segment. At the same time, while online gamers were more fit, they were less fit in terms of mental health. They tend to show more signs of depression and chemical addiction.
I wonder why. You're sitting in a dark room all the time and have no human touch. That could be part of it.
They were also saying that it might also be due to stress in the workplace, that games ended up being someplace that...
Some kind of relief.
Yeah.
So that if you have a high-stress kind of work, your burn-off is to play video games for a long period of
time. More players were in their 30s than their 20s, older players tended to spend more time in the game.
Interesting.
And while there were fewer women who played games than men, of those women, they played longer than their male compatriots.
Cool. Thank you, Miles, for that update on electronic game or online gaming. Hey, I want to let you all know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Today on All Things Considered, singer Joan Osborne was born in Kentucky, but she's made New York City her home. Her new album is a stroll through the city she loves. Today, walking the streets of New York with Joan Osborne on All Things Considered from NPR News, starting at 5 p.m. here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Auto, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Coming up next, we're going to have Car Talk, but first, I want to let you know that GeekSpeak's here for you all the time. You can go up to GeekSpeak.org and ask us questions anytime you like on our forums, or just send us an email, and we have a responsive rate of about 70%. No, I would say 30%. Yeah, that's right. That's an inversion. So if you don't hear back from us, it's not because we don't love you. It's just because we're really busy. But we would love your questions, and we will try to get to them.
For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.